like a snake that slowly winds away and retreats out of sight. That feeling dissipated with the rear guard of flashing police cars, the highway truckers, and the stuck-behind-the-damn-parade summer travelers anxious to get to wherever they were in a hurry to go. The cars lining Main Street started up almost on cue, pulling away from the curbs as our family and friends made their way to the kitchen to gorge on my mother's picnic fares. But Cousin Clarence never came to our Memorial Day get-togethers. He was dead. I never even knew him. I was born 20 years after the war that killed him began. I don't quite remember the year that it dawned on me. I forsook the family picnic and folded in with the tail end of the parade after it passed the house, walking a few blocks on slate slab sidewalks to the black wrought iron entrance to Union Cemetery. Here, I was notified by a volley of shots that I was too late for the words of wisdom from the town fathers. But that was okay. Amidst the parade flotsam on the side of Main Street, I saw a small American flag lying in the sand. I stopped to pick it up and continued on further to the smaller cemetery behind Union, where I knew a special grave marker was located, the one my father would bring me to on our occasional walks in my boyhood. Sergeant Clarence B. McGuire, a courageous and gallant gunner who gave all for God and country, July 29, 1944. May his soul and all the souls of the gallant men who died rest in peace. Clarence B. McGuire. Dad remembered Clarence coming to visit and teasing him in a playful manner when Dad was only in grade school. We had a crew photo of him, which I saw from time to time growing up, and which I rediscovered while cleaning out Dad's desk after he passed. It was the only photo I had ever seen of Clarence. Tall, centered in the rear row, just beaming and smiling. Clary was one of the waist gunners in this B-17 crew. You get the impression that they all got along, that maybe they were pals, teammates, probably friends for life. But somebody, maybe his mother, anointed this picture with a cross over his head. He didn't come back, you see. The entire crew in this picture was killed on a bombing mission when the plane exploded on July 29, 1944, somewhere over Germany. Friends for life, blown out of the sky, just parts of twisted metal and burning chunks tumbling to the German soil. Even as an adult, the photo always haunted me a bit. All died in an instant, probably only months after this was taken. Flowers scythed down in the springtime of life. All gone. Or so I thought. I planted the tiny flag at his memorial and walked away. A seed was also being planted. I would be back. I've given a good deal of thought on how to approach telling the story of the air war in Europe in World War II. In my first book, I unfolded the war in the Pacific through the words of the veterans, specifically using the wartime prisoner diary of Joe Minder as a chronological guide. My original goal was to do something similar here, but it was proving more difficult. I had different airplanes my subjects were on, different theaters and Army Air Forces, different times and objectives during the European War. Some readers may be disappointed by a lack of technical detail or a political history, but my focus wound up being drawn to an entirely different path. As it turned out, most of the veterans interviewed for this book served in the U.S. 8th Army Air Force based in England. But rather than serve up to the reader another rehashing of the mighty 8th story, there are already many detailed books out there, and I'd probably recommend Donald L. Miller's Masters of the Air over most of the others. I decided it would be fairer to our storytellers if they could share their own experiences individually. As I racked my brain for a narrative thread, I walked away and sat down to do some proofing. Then I noticed something. As it turned out, each of the men I was drawn to held a different crew position on the heavy bombers of the B-24 Liberator or the B-17 Flying Fortress. I had a new